Now we turn to Bill Resnick and Jenny Brown to talk about the politics of reproductive justice, past and present. Bill?
Hi, Jenny Brown. Welcome to KABU.
It's great to be here.
Jenny Brown is a women's liberation organizer and writer, once an editor of Labor Notes for 10 years. She co-chaired the Alachua County Labor Party, organizing for national health insurance, the right to a job and a living wage, and, of course, Working Persons Political Party under the Labor Party slogan, "The corporations have two parties, we need one of our own." Over the last several years, she's been writing, teaching, and organizing with National Women's Liberation Organization. She was a leader in the grassroots campaign to make morning after pill contraception available over the counter in the United States and was a plaintiff in the winning lawsuit. She's the author of Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work, and Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. So, Jenny Brown, you've been writing long before the recent Texas provocation. You've been writing that abortion is on the ropes, that the U.S. Supreme Court is clearly bent on reversing Roe v. Wade, or perhaps more boldly even, and what I'm afraid of, creating a legal standard of when life begins in the early fetus and holding the states to that standard. So, Jenny Brown, give us a story, a thumbnail sketch of how the forces that won legal abortion in this country, how they were demobilized. How did it happen? And then we can discuss how we can today again build popular power, not only to abolish abortion restrictions, but also win a great deal more of the reproductive freedom and women's liberation program.
Well, the movement to change the abortion law, abortion was legal for the first 100 years of the U.S.'s existence, and then it was made illegal in 1873, and that followed 100 years of repression. And in the late 60s, there were a lot of groups of well-meaning lawyers and doctors and just ordinary women who wanted to change the abortion laws, and many of the things that they suggested were, you know, well, let's make it okay if you already have four children or if you are the victim of rape, that kind of exception to what were all over the country laws against abortion, making it illegal. And this movement bumped along for many years with a few victories, but the victories were almost as bad as defeat because it meant that, you know, you had to go before a hospital board, prove you were suicidal, whatever, made people jump through a lot of hoops, and abortion actually was not any more available than it had been before. Well, by 67 and 68, the young women who were involved in the women's liberation movement, who started the women's liberation movement, including the group Red Stockings, decided that this strategy was actually backwards, that rather than demanding exception to the law, we should get the law repealed entirely. So they set out to do that and were fairly successful. And there were even lawsuits where the courts were starting to dismantle the law. And in New York State, the New York State legislature passed a law in 1970 that basically made abortions legal up through the second trimester as long as they were performed by a doctor. That was the most liberal law in the country. And the way they won that was basically by testifying about their own abortions, talking about the illegal abortions that they had had, and really joining forces with the other big movements of the time to make a demand to make this change. By 1973, the Supreme Court was very worried that some states would have no abortion law at all, which was, of course, the movement's goal. So quickly retrenched and managed to make this decision, Roe, which now has become sort of the limit of the possible, right? But then it was kind of a compromise, and it still had various things the feminist movement didn't want. And the most important thing, of course, is it gave a right, but it didn't provide actual access because you still had to pay for it. And the requirement that doctors do it in many states drove the price up. So it never really made abortion available to everybody who needed one. So how was the movement demobilized? I think to some extent there was a backlash against all of the movements. Some experienced a great deal of repression. Others were sort of undermined by parallel organizing. But in general, throughout the 70s, the movements were largely demobilized. And in the abortion arena, it was in favor of a sort of a more respectable, non-profit-y kind of approach where we would just talk about the extreme cases, rape, incest, life of the mother, sort of going back to the original failed strategy. And this is the strategy of people who are helping other people, not people who are fighting to overthrow their own oppression. So that part of the movement was sort of sidelined in favor of this nonprofit strategy. And that's basically where it has stood. We have been fighting a losing battle, you know, getting pushed backwards every year. Since the early 80s, we've been experiencing more and more restrictions on abortion rights, and the court has been slowly allowing more restrictions on abortion rights, including, obviously, we have things like the waiting periods requiring ultrasounds, which drives up the price. The waiting period also drives up the price because you have to do two visits and figure out how to accomplish that. If you live a long way away, you have to make two trips. Parental notification and parental consent laws, which are pretty endemic now, and generally a lot of attacks on the clinics themselves, which arose basically because after abortion was legalized, hospitals were worried about their reputations and refused, in most cases, to provide abortion. So the movement had to start its own clinics to make abortion available at all. And that's why we have the clinics we have now. So this is sort of in the situation, and we've been fighting legal and legislative battles, but the battles in the streets have not been able to get the traction that we had in the late 60s and early 70s. And I think it's partly because our strategy has not been to appeal to everyday women, but more to appeal to the power structure.
Right. This is cable. This is supported radio every day. Cable reminds you another better world is possible, and indeed nowadays necessary. Bill Resnick here for your Old Mole Variety Hour. The variety, of course, is in the struggles from below that we cover and appreciate. I'm talking to Jenny Brown, who works with the Women's Liberation Organization, organizing and writing. Her last book is Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. We've been discussing how we got to this point where abortion rights will likely disappear soon. So, Jenny Brown, the Supreme Court is poised to reverse Roe v. Wade or worse. And it seems to me now there's little we can do to stop it. Still, women across the country are organizing for a great march October 2nd, 2.5 weeks from now. My sense is it's going to be the beginning of something big, a real organizing campaign. For folks listening to cable, you'll hear all about the details on this radio station. Jenny, I'm sure you're going to be speaking somewhere at one of the October 2nd marches, discussing what must be done, how basically to win. What sort of movement will be necessary? You've already alluded to it. We'll go into more detail. Will be necessary to win abortion rights and indeed the reproductive autonomy and justice, and in fact, not just the rights to terminate an unwanted pregnancy, the rights to have children, which is being eroded by the economic and social circumstances of a good percentage of the and precariousness of a good percentage of the population. What do you see happening to the women's liberation struggle?
Well, first of all, there is a bill in Congress which has been introduced since 2013 called the Women's Health Protection Act, which would basically stop states from restricting abortion before viability. So it's not everything that the women's liberation movement originally demanded, but it basically codifies the Roe decision. You know, the Democrats could have presumably passed this one of the many times they've had a majority over the last, 48 years, right? But now we really have a chance to demand it. Of course, it's very likely that the Republicans would filibuster. And this is the problem. I think a lot of feminists are squeamish about the Democratic Senate getting rid of the filibuster. They think, well, the Senate is, you know, is an undemocratic body, right? But at least the filibuster, which basically means you need 60 votes to pass anything, the filibuster keeps worse things from happening. Well, that would be all very well. But what in fact has been happening is the Supreme Court has been making rulings, getting rid of the Voting Rights Act, limiting, you know, basically destroying unions in the public sector, allowing unlimited corporate cash in elections, and now allowing Texas to ban abortion. And there's legislation sitting there that could respond to any of those things and the many other things that we could all think of, but it can't be passed because 40 senators say no. So the filibuster is actually making an undemocratic body, the Senate, even more undemocratic, while giving the courts even more power than they should have. And the courts are laying waste to the few rights that we won over the years through all our hard struggle, right? So this has to end somewhere. And I think that it's important to point out that there's nothing to stop the Republicans, if they get a majority next time, from getting rid of the filibuster either. I mean, they did it for the Supreme Court confirmations, which is why we're actually talking right now about abortion becoming illegal in Texas. And there's a whole pile of things working people need that are currently being held up by the filibuster, or at least that's what the Democrats have been telling us, right? The PRO Act, which would basically put some laws on the side of workers trying to organize a union, $15 minimum wage. So there are a lot of things that we can unite with the rest of the movement around in pushing for a whole panel of things. And I think now we can say abortion should be also among those. The current situation with the Women's Health Protection Act is that there are 48 Democratic co-sponsors in the Senate. Joe Manchin in West Virginia and Bob Casey in Pennsylvania are the only two holdouts. And no Republicans have signed on, although Susan Collins in Maine and Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, you know, nominally support abortion rights. So I think pushing Congress on that is a top priority. And then we have to think about the other things that we need, right? As you were saying, you know, the right to have an abortion means nothing if you don't have the money to get one. So that's why we need expanded and improved Medicare for All bill, which is in both houses. And also, obviously, if we could get it, even if we could get enough Democrats to support it, the Republicans would filibuster it. And that would cover all reproductive options. So the combination of those two laws would give us a lot better situation than we have now. But we're told we can't get anything. And the sort of the sight of what we could imagine happening, I mean, even the possibility of a Green New Deal, everybody says, well, you can't do that because of the filibuster. So I think we have to call the Democrats on their bluff and see if they really are going to defend reproductive rights and all of these other things that we need. And it's an opportunity for us to unite with other portions of the movement that are pushing for this.
This is cable listener-supported radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety. I'm talking to Jenny Brown. Her latest book is Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. We've been discussing how we got to this point and what kind of movement will be necessary to gain abortion rights and indeed the social services and incomes that make it possible for women to have full lives and raise children. Jenny, one last issue. There's several European societies that have abortion on demand and universal single-payer medical care and child care, much longer paid vacations, and yet they're ruled by white male elites who make the key decisions in the society. It's sort of a semi-welfare capitalism being eroded slowly over the years, but still so superior to the precariousness and pain and overwork that probably a majority of American families are subjected to. So the question for me is partly, how do we go beyond just these social democratic material gains, as important as they are? How do we build the foundations of a different kind of society, the kind of society actually that's going to become necessary if we're ever going to deal with climate change? The old America cannot last very long. We cannot keep consuming and creating pollution at the rate we are throughout the world. And that's going to require really building a different way of producing what we produce and what, in fact, are the ways that our cities and our families operate. Jenny, I don't know if you've thought about these questions, but how do we go beyond just trying to make material gains in this society and activate a sufficient number of people so that it's the left that, in fact, directs and implements something like the Green New Deal rather than the right and the corporations who have their own idea of how to deal with climate change. They're making it very clear that they believe a lot of new technologies can save our system so they can stay and maintain their same privilege and operations in our post-climate change world. How do you see that kind of movement? There's a movement now, it seems to me, we're fighting for our lives now. And the women's movement and the reproductive rights and movement is fundamental to the answer to climate change. How do you see that kind of movement, a real crusade happening?
First of all, in Europe, where abortion rights was first introduced after the revolution in Russia in 1919, they made abortion legal for the first time anywhere. So there's a long socialist tradition of standing up to the religious powers that say we shouldn't have abortion, and the capitalist powers that say we shouldn't have abortion. And in European countries that continue to have some social democratic programs, the reason that they have them is that the labor movements were strong enough in the post-war period to put in national healthcare systems, which then, when the feminist movement demanded abortion, those were included in the national healthcare system. So that resulted in a much better situation for women and all parents in those countries. So I think that basically we need to struggle on the basic things that everyone needs. You know, we need to unite the many to defeat the few, and I think this is a great opportunity to do it. Obviously, some of the questions that you're asking are much larger and longer discussion. But the basic principles are that everything that we have, we fought for. You know, the Supreme Court did not give us abortion rights. We fought for them. And similarly, we're going to have to fight for everything we get. And the way to do that is to unite as many people as possible who have, you know, the vast majority, the 99%, whatever you want to call it, have an interest in changing the system fundamentally. And we can see it every day as things get worse and worse. So some of these crises are going to result in new alliances and new formations that I think will get us out of the crisis and make a better future.
Jenny Brown, thanks so much for talking to us today. Where can we find, I know we can find a number of your articles on Jacobin. What do you suggest?
I have a blog called Birth Strike. It's birthstrike.blog. And that has a collection of articles about these issues, and then Jacobin, and then my work in Labor Notes is on the Labor Notes website. So that's a good selection of stuff. The Birth Strike book is published by PM Press, and you can get it from them.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Jenny Brown.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Really enjoyed it.